Okay, final half hour and we're out of here. Just as I was ending, there was a question about this last line. And again, it's very apropos to what I said a couple of times, namely, we're on both sides of the fence with respect to making things like backslash n magic. So the question is, what does this mean? What did I mean to represent here? Could have been two things. And in your scanner, you'll actually use backslash n both ways. So the question is, do I mean this to be two characters, backslash n? The answer is no. Because remember, the escape sequences typically are used in a quoted string or a quoted character. And I'm not in either of those. I mean this to be just as if I was in Java or C or C++, the new line character. I write it down because it's more readable than some octal sequence that happens to be the new line character. So in this case, I'm just plain old user, just like you. And it says, if you see this single character represents the end of line, the new line, please go ahead and process it. And you can tell that by noticing I'm only incrementing the line number by one and resetting the column. So in that case, I'm treating it as if jumped to the new line. So when you get around to doing it, you'll have to worry about turning off the magic in some cases where you say, I want to actually match backslash n, the two characters. And I think we said earlier that quoting would do that. Another alternative would be to escape out this backslash, because that's the guy that initiates the magic. So later on, you may want to say, I want to represent two characters. The user actually wrote backslash and then n. I'm going to process that, and at some stage, I may then change it to the magic internal character. You'll need to do that, as I said, if you had a quoted backslash n. What would happen is when you scan that, you get four characters back, as it gives you exactly what it scanned. It's up to you to pull it apart. You then say, okay, the first and the last characters are always ticks. I throw those away. Those are irrelevant. Now I say, do I have one character or two? If I have one character, it's a typical quoted character and no problem. If I have two, it's got to be one of the escape sequences, and I can then go and say, if your third character here is an N, then you mean the backslash. If it's a T, you mean the tab. If it's another backslash, you mean the backslash, etc. So you need to do that. Interestingly enough, in quoted strings, which are the more complex of the two, you don't need to do the conversion because, as it happens, Jasmine, the assembler we're going to use eventually, wants strings in quoted form. So we got them in quoted form. We could convert them and then back, but that's silly. That's wasted effort. So we keep it in quoted form, and we'll just plug that into the generated code we do. So I'm giving you a little flavor of this nastiness of going from escaped form into the actual character and then possibly back again. But in strings, it's not a problem. It's a slight problem in quoted characters. So all this stuff then, there's a question of what all this fits into the build process. This thing is normally going to be a file with the name .lex, jlex, I'm sorry, because it's a jlex form command. So it might be cxlite.jlex or csx.jlex. We then run it through the actual jlex program, which will create exactly the same file name. So I'd go from csx.jlex, and all it will do is append Java and create a new file. And that's the implementation of the scanner you specified in Java. Therefore, it's compilable and can be called then by Java programs, as we'll show you. So this is the actual driver. Here, you'll need to change a little, but not too much. Some of the stuff is just standard gobbledygook I need to do to handle some error cases. I could let you figure them out, but you'd be wasted effort. This is really not much to do with compiling and a lot to do with Java programming. So it turns out that I got to throw the exception because the scanner might. Here I'm just checking that I have an input file on the command line. So I say it better be the case that I have one argument on the command line. If so, if not, I give it an error message and exit out. Otherwise, I go ahead and try to open it. If I fail on opening it, I complain that you gave me a file that doesn't exist. Otherwise, I'll go ahead and I'll take the name of the file, which is yylex, and it's a file input stream, and call a constructor that says the generated scanner will give me a scan object, which is called yylex for historical reasons, and I'll, in this particular case, call this thing lex situation. And this will actually be the guy I'll call when I want to do scanning. So I print out a title line saying I'm beginning the testing. And whenever I want a token, all I do is take Lex and call the YYLex method. It says, take this file object, which is to be scanned, and it's in the middle of scanning, and give me another token. Eventually, it'll give me the end of file token, and that's my indication to quit calling because I'm done. So in this particular case, I have just a few tokens. So in this particular case, I say, as long as the token is not the end of file token, I'll keep going. So what you'll do is take these particular print statements and extend them for all the tokens. So what I'm doing is, as I read a token, I print it out, and I'll show you an example of that. These are can come in just about any order, because remember, it's a switch statement. So it says, if I'm an intlet, I print out the fact, hey, I saw an integer literal, put it in parens, and then take that integer value and print it out with a closed paren and break. If it's a plus, I just print out the plus. And I guess I put back a tab, so I tab in, so it all comes out in a nice uniform column. Not equal, I print out the not equal symbol. Default is in there intentionally. It says, if I try to do a test where I don't have a token definition for it yet, it ought to terminate me, because it can't print out something I just scanned. So what you do is, as you add new tokens, say, oh, I'm going to go into the JLEX def and add star for multiplication. At the same time, you want to go into this guy and create something very similar to this that says, if you see a sim.star, you don't print out a plus sign, obviously you print out a star. So that way you give the definition, but you also have something to print it out so you can trace that it's actually matching the tokens as expected. So what you'll be doing is going ahead and adding new lines in the JLEX definition and in the tester, adding new entries into the switch saying, if I find one of these, here's what I want you to do. And typically all it does is print the line number, print the column number, print the name of the thing, and if it's got a value, like an integer or an identifier, print the actual contents so you can verify it scanned the right thing. And that's basically all you need to do. A little later, I'll talk about error handling. After everything's working properly, we may want to add a little extra error handling. At a minimum, we'll want to do this dot business for illegal tokens, and we might want to do some special handling for things like quoted strings, which, if they somehow get messed up, may be problematic. And I'll talk about that, but don't worry about that until you have the other things working. So let me switch over and actually do a run on this thing. This is what you'll download if you haven't already. I don't know why this thing is so slow. Golly. I'm going to figure out something on here. So I'm in Project 2. I'm going to go to build and do a clean. I'm not sure. I've been playing with this recently. Now do a test. Okay, let's take a look at what our input was here. So that's right. I just need to get the default editor here. I just tried that, and that didn't work too well. Oh, that's right. Nope. What it's trying to do is it's trying to call Vim, which doesn't exist anymore on this version. Now, open with is what I want. Let's see if I can find that. Oh, right below me, duh. Talking too long here. Yeah. So this is just an example of what happened. So this is the input. Remember, it doesn't have to be a valid CSX program. So in this particular case, I just wrote some lines that involved the tokens I believed I had working. So I had integer literals, not equal, end of line, plus sign, and so on. And all this guy does is print out one token per line. Here's the line number and column number. And it says, I saw an integer literal 1, 2, 3. I then saw not equal. It does not print out anything about non-tokens. So new lines, blanks, and so on aren't printed. They're consumed, but they're not terribly interesting. So we go ahead and do that. And since this does not have to be a valid program, as I said, as you're adding new tokens, you can simply take an existing test file and add new things onto it. It's always a good idea to verify that what used to work still does. It should not change, but should not and feeling sure that it doesn't are two different things. So in terms of what you need to change, let's look at here and... So here's that, what I just showed on the screen. So you'll go ahead and take this, and the JLEX you'll be changing primarily by adding new lines towards the bottom here. You'll then go ahead and the driver, which I showed you, is in P2. And what you'll have to do there is toward the bottom there in the switch. And it even tells you to extend the code to add new cases for that. And that'll be primarily where you do your work. Add new test cases, add the token definition, and then go ahead and build it. And let's see. Yeah, as I was saying, this thing here, csx.jlex.java, is something you can look at just if you're interested, but you never have to actually change. This is the generated scanner from what you have. So let's look at that just... Oh, it's out of sync. That's right. Let's do a refresh. It's out of sync because I just built it again as I was demoing it. Oh, cool. So you can go and look at this. You know, it'll make some sense, but not a heck of a lot of sense. A lot of detail work there, but you can see all the stuff that you might have had a program. So this thing, even for a tiny little sample, has buffering and all sorts of nonsense. And in the old days, building a scanner would involve doing some quantity of that, which made it a nasty thing. This is the table that encodes the actual scanning operations and a variety of things. You're welcome to look at it. Parts of your code are in there and a lot of other stuff to make it all work is added. So the cool part is you don't have to implement that. You hardly ever have to look at it. Occasionally, somebody trips across some funny bug or something, we may need to look at it, but normally not. This is the equivalent of a translation of a program where you look at the source file and execute the translation, but never actually look at the translation. So any questions on that? So let's get out of that. I just wanted to show that, in theory, it all worked. So let's talk about a couple of other issues. These have to do with error handling and limitations and so on that might come to mind. After you've read this part, you'll pretty much be at a position where you can start actually working on the project. There may be some questions that carry on, but you still have 3 weeks. So certainly doing some of the easier stuff, download from the web page and do a couple of easy tokens just to get your feet wet is a great way to start and then get into the more complex things. So I've already talked a little bit about this, but how do you handle reserved words? Turns out there's a variety of ways that people have historically done it, and there's one way that I strongly recommend to you. So in the earliest days, people created a separate scope, a separate symbol table just for reserved words. And the notion is there, when you look up an identifier, when you scan what you think is an identifier, you check the reserved words and see if it's in there or not. The difficulty with this is it's not all that hard for this table of reserved words to get out of sync with the definition of the scanner, since it's not generated as part of the build process. So you can imagine somebody adding some new reserved words and not putting them in the table. So that's always an issue. And again, we have all sorts of issues of that where something changes and not everybody gets told. I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and I remember in the 70s, there'd be the weather person. And the weather person would show temperatures. And if you can visualize where Buffalo is, it's just across the border from Canada. So they give information on Hamilton, which is a place, Toronto, which I'm sure you all heard of. But what happened is, at the point where Canada changed to metric, it was in the middle of the summer, they had all these temperatures in Buffalo and parts in the States that was 70s and 80s and so on. And they showed the Canadian temperatures, and they were like 21 or 22. And somebody had forgotten to tell the weather person that there was such a thing as centigrade as well as Fahrenheit. And this person was amazed that just going across the border, you went from nice summery weather to something in the 20s. Now, I guess many of you understand metrics, and I guess a temperature in the 20s Celsius is a pretty decent temperature, isn't it? And I guess 25 is a real hot day, is that right? So something in the 20s is not out of range. So anyway, it's a matter of this thing got changed. The Canadians said, we're going to report our temperatures in Celsius from now on. But nobody told the people in the States that, hey, you're going to get these new numbers and there's this thing called Celsius and don't be too surprised. So embarrassment, but I mean, it happens. So same sort of thing here where you can change it and if not everybody knows about it, you're in trouble. And all software projects have that to some extent. Turns out, theoretically, you can do something that nobody does, but it's kind of cool just to see that it would work, that you can create a really complex-looking regular expression that actually gives you all the identifiers minus the reserve words, which is exactly what we'd want. The trouble is these overbars aren't normally implemented, and this thing is pretty complex. So let me show you what happens here, because it's not clear this ought to work. So what happens is you talk about all possible identifiers. So that include reserve words. So let's say A to Z, capitals two, A to Z plus. And that's not quite right, but something like that. So what happens is you get all the identifiers that look like this. And what I'm going to do is create a Venn diagram. Do they still teach Venn diagrams in school? They did when I was a kid, and it's kind of cool sometimes. So you say, the overbar on ident says, give me everything that's not an identifier. That would include commas and semicolons and white space and all that. So that represents all the stuff outside the circle. That's the non-idents. So go ahead in there and now add in to these non-idents the reserved words like if and while. And these are on the outside. And now complemented a second time. So that gets rid of all these, but also gets rid of the if and while and gives you the ident minus the reserved words. Oh, yeah, that's even better if you can see it. So I did three stages. I first got all non-identifiers, but then I added in using the OR operator, the reserved words, but then I complemented again. So the reserved words got to get kicked out because they're complemented out. But all the other identifiers which were in the circles are still there. So it's kind of a cool thing that it works. You're not going to use it, but occasionally it's nice just to see how powerful the notation can be. In a way, you can subtract everything away and get just the residue. What we do, and what I'm going to recommend to you, is simply give a distinct regular expression pattern to each reserved word and also one pattern for the identifier, and then use this priority business to say reserved words come first, so anything that matches a reserved word gets grabbed as such. If it gets past the reserved words down to the identifiers, that's essentially the same thing as identifiers minus reserved words. As I understand it, three reasons. One, they didn't do it in the past, so if the old guys got away with it, we don't. Secondly, it's tricky to use properly. I won't today, but in a later lecture, I'll show you something that looks like it ought to work, but doesn't. There's an old saying that for every hard problem, there's a simple solution, and it's usually wrong. There's a case on that. And it sometimes can blow up in the sense it can give you a lot more states than you expected by temporarily throwing away everything. So it can make the scanner bigger than you would have expected. So I won't say that there's no scanner generator at all that doesn't use it. There might be, but none that I've used. It might be something to fish around and play with. But something there that it's costly and tricky to use, and people have decided they really don't need it. But theoretically, it would work, and there's nothing in the theory I'm going to develop in later lectures that would forbid doing it. In fact, in some ways, it's pretty elegant, and this is at least one way of showing that if you can understand this. The trouble is the two overbars scare the heck out of people. One overbar is not so bad, but complement and then uncomplement or recomplement or whatever you call it. Maybe you're braver than I am. You're a math major probably. No. Well, you're good. I have a situation. There are a lot of people where anything that has what looks like math in it is scary. Situation. And for a long time, there's a lot of debates about whether programming languages ought to look a lot less like mathematics, because there's a large segment of the population that had some element of math phobia. Situation here, you know that. It's been going back to high school. For you, it's not so long. For me, it's a lot longer. There were two classes of kids. One would say, oh, we're getting to be our junior, senior year. We're going to go calculus. I mean, oh, good, I'm learning calculus. There says calculus, and they run the other direction. Get me out of here, anything and everything, but I don't want to do calculus. So it's a situation. If you're scared of math, and historically people have been scared of computing, and that's not necessarily so because computing is getting so pervasive, we have to have ways to make computing accessible to more and more people. Nobody quite knows the right way of doing it, but they know a lot of wrong ways of doing it. So if we do enough wrong ways, maybe we'll trip across the right way. But so anyway, that's just something, we'll talk more about that later, but it's something that is doable, but I've never seen anybody actually implement it that way. It's not to say it might not have been done and simply somebody didn't bother to tell me because, I don't know, they just didn't know I was interested. Converting token values. This is something you do need to know. And here, the issue here is I've got an integer that's just a string of characters. I can make that as long as I want. Nothing in the scanner is going to stop me from doing that. So the question is, what do I do if I see a valid integer that's way too big to represent it? Well, I could call it a flat-out error. What I'm going to recommend is we call it an integer literal and give it either the largest representable positive or negative value, depending on whether it's a positive or negative integer. And, of course, give a warning message or an error message saying, error, integer literal too large to be represented. We'll continue with the scanning and compiling process, but understand you're not getting the number you thought you were getting. So that's what we want to do. And again, the string may represent numbers bigger and bigger. There are 32 and 64-bit integers. I know some scientific machines have floating point with 128 bits, quad precision. Even that, believe it or not, for some simulations is not enough. 128 bits is a lot of bits, and you can imagine if you're doing simulations, you're carrying something out to long, long, long decimal points to make a difference. But scientists have used it, and apparently it's important. You also have to worry about the fact that we use TWDL, Java uses minus, so you're going to have to intervene personally, get rid of the TWDL, maybe change it to a minus as you do the conversion. That's a minor thing, but it is a gotcha. So what we're going to do is, we're not going to try to convert this string to an integer straight away, because if it's too big, we're going to get in problems. I want to be able to give a nice error message. So what we're going to do is create something called a double. That's a double precision floating point. That's good for two reasons. Namely, it's bigger than a single. That's great. You know, give me two for the price of one. And it's floating point, so I can have a big exponent. But even better, the floating point standard in most computers has been done very nicely, and there actually exist bit patterns in the floating point representation that the hardware knows about that is able to represent something as plus or minus infinity. Mathematicians will tell you there you can't compute with infinity and all that, but you can have something that says this is too big to represent in any finite precision that we have on our machine and compare against it. So in that particular case, we can say, did you give me infinity? If so, then for sure I can't represent it, and I give an error message. It's still possible that you gave me a number that's too big to be represented by a 32 or 64-bit integer, but is representable as a 64-bit floating. Remember, floating point have an exponent, so you can have essentially more digits to the left. But what you can do there is you simply go ahead and take the double value and compare it against integer max value and integer min value. These are predefined constants that says in the integers we have on our machine, either 32 or 64, depending on what the configuration is, here's the biggest and smallest you can represent. That is the most positive and the most negative. So what you do is you actually go ahead and do the comparison and say if it's a valid integer, you simply cast it. And you can cast the double value known to be in range into a valid integer, and bingo, you got it. If it failed by either coming up with plus or minus infinity or comparing bigger than or less than max value or min value, you simply give an error message, too big to represent. I'm going to replace it with either the biggest positive or the biggest negative or the most negative integer around and continue processing. So this is a comparatively easy thing to program. All the heavy lifting is done by the Java folks. And this is how to handle the problem that you have values that are unpredictably large. Again, remember, you got to handle the TWDL. All you do there is ask, is the first character TWDL? If so, pull it off, convert it as if it were a positive number, and then convert it as a positive number, negate it to change it to minus, and then do the testing as outlined here. Termination. In our case, it's pretty easy because we actually have an end the file token done by the scanner. But notice what would happen is if you had to program this. Turns out that programming end the file is remarkably difficult because it's entirely possible you might have to hit end the file before you're at end the file. Well, that sounds crazy. And it sounds like things, like we had to pass the law to understand what was in the law. In this case, we have to hit end the file before we recognize end the file. And what happens there is suppose I happen to have something where my last line was not terminated by a new line. Notice there's no rule that actually says it has to. You can imagine a program being one huge long line with no new lines at all in it. New lines are really just for humans. That's why we throw them away as white space. But imagine I had, and then this brick wall, that's the end of file sort of situation. You know, you look over the edge and it drops you down. And someday I'll tell you offline about my famous Niagara Falls story, but I won't say that now because it gets me too excited. Or frightened, I guess, actually. Oh, the long and short of it is, when I was a kid, about 5 or 6 years old, being near Buffalo, I was visiting Niagara Falls. And on the Canadian side, anybody been to the Canadian Falls? It's a pretty cool place. There's a spot right where they had a little wall about yay high that looks over the brink of the falls. Water here, gap there. And I was four or five, just at the age where I started remembering, I couldn't see. So my grandfather picks me up, holds me over the wall, and lets me look down. I remember that to this day, and then I let out the scream of all screams in situation. So that's like this. You're looking over, not the edge of the world, but the edge of Niagara Falls. And Niagara Falls is pretty scary, particularly when you're 4 or 5 years old. So, but here's the issue here. This is one of the things that's taken care of by the scanner generator, so good for you. But imagine you were reading, and you say A equals 1. Okay, no, I'm sorry. Let's not make it a semicolon. Let's make it 1, 1. And we hit the end of the world here. Well, how do I know that I'm at the end of the world? The only way I do is try to read another character, and that means I'm at end the file. But I haven't reached end the file yet, and I can't return end the file because I want to return, in this case, 11. That's a valid token. It just happened to be the very last character in the file. So there's a situation where if I was programming this by hand, I have to be able to read end the file, reach end the file, but not consume it, because I haven't yet returned the end the file token that tells the parser that it's ready to complete the parse and start processing the rest of the program. So what some systems do, and this gets kind of nasty, is you can actually create a character that doesn't exist. Never knew that was possible. Maybe it shouldn't be. But it turns out that in ASCII characters, there's 128 valid characters. But characters are almost always stored in a byte, which gives you 256 possibilities. So one possibility is to create a new pseudo character that represents end the file. And when I, quote, read end the file, which you never quite do, I actually return to the scanner the end the file character. And now it gets a lot easier because if I have an end the file character, I can write patterns that do that. You don't have to worry about it because it takes care of it. But if they do that, and in fact, in some situations, Java, for example, input stream.read will actually return a -1 when end the file is hit just to handle that problem I showed you. But you have to know that these things exist. Sometimes hitting end the file terminates you. Sometimes you get a magic character. Oh, oops. Okay, let's pick this up next time then. Since you don't have to program this, this is more for scientific interest, not for necessity. So you have enough information now that you can start doing the scanner if you care to. If not, certainly I'll be talking more about scanner next week. And at that time, I'll probably have some questions from you about specific issues.